Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang gunuttarang upajayang namasami.
Today being the lunar observance, or the one prat, as we call it in Thailand, see the occasion which the lay Buddhists request the eight precepts, and the request of the eight precepts contains within itself a number of important teachings, but perhaps the most easily overlooked is the fact that the precepts are requested rather than given unilaterally by the ajahn or the teacher. And this is because the sila, morality, in Buddhism is not part of a system or a belief system in which we believe that obeying certain rules will lead to certain rewards, and not obeying the rules will lead to punishment. But in the Buddhist tradition, we consider ourselves intelligent enough to create boundaries for our conduct through body and speech, and to create harmony, trust in the community through making use of this wonderful capacity we have not to do certain things that our instincts tell us to do. So we might have an instinct or a desire to take something that's not given, or to lie, for instance, and we don't do that. Why don't we? Well, because it wouldn't be right. and so this is, I think, a wonderful capacity we have, which we take for granted, something that we do over and over again in our daily lives, a passing thought to do or say something is rejected because we feel it would be inappropriate, improper, unfair, unkind, or so on. And it is this basic human capacity which we draw upon in the sila training. So it is a training, it's an education of conduct, and one which has to be voluntary. If it's felt that we refrain from certain things, act in certain ways because of some punishment from outside ourselves, which might ensue from not doing so, then it may well lead to a certain order in family or a society, but it wouldn't be the training in sila, because it wouldn't lead to samadhi and panya. The eight precepts are a step up from the five precepts, but the differences and the additional precepts are not directly concerned with the most important ethical injunctions. They are precepts of renunciation. And I'm reminded of a story, ancient Indian story, about taking the eight precepts. And, bit wary with stories these days. I recently, in Thailand, I told a story, and someone came up to me afterwards and said, I read that story already in one of your books. Oh, that's all right. But then he said, and I think it was better in the book. But anyway, this one isn't in a book. So, and there are a lot of Buddhist stories about monkeys. And this is a story about monkeys. And there was this group of monkeys who had a big meeting on the Lunar Observance Day. And they said, you know, we've been Buddhists for a long time, but we've never really got round to this eight precept thing on the Lunar Observance Day. What do you think? And they sat in a big circle and talked about it. And it was generally agreed that it's a good idea, but you know, the one difficult precept was obviously going to be number six, not eating bananas in the evening. There were legitimate worries about potassium deficiency and carbohydrate lack and so on. But it was generally agreed in the end that they'd go for it, the eight precepts. But then somebody spoke up and said, look, we haven't done this before and we need to really think this through. If we're going to sit and meditate all night, tomorrow morning we're going to be really exhausted. And then we've got to go climbing around all around the forest finding bananas. I'm just worried that we're just not going to have the energy to be able to do it. You know, have we considered this properly? So they said, okay. And they said, well, let's go and gather all the bananas right now. And then they'll be there in the morning and we won't have to go off searching for them. So that's what they did. And they got this big pile of bananas and put them in the middle of the forest there and all ready to go tomorrow morning. And then one of the monkeys said, look, We all live in our various homes throughout the forest. We've still got to come out into the central area and pick up these bananas, you know. I think we're going to be really tired. I mean, what's the point? Why don't we just make a pile of bananas in front of our houses? And then in the morning, there they are, and we can just eat them straight away. Well, that made sense. So they did that. And then one of the younger monkeys said, oh, I don't know about this. It's going to be really exhausting. And I think we should peel the bananas this evening. I mean, I just don't know whether I'm going to have the energy to do this peeling business tomorrow after being up all night. So, yeah, okay, that makes sense. So they peeled all the bananas. And then this young monkey's young sister, she said, I don't think that's a good idea. Anybody could steal those bananas during the night or could get ants come and eat them. I think when we sit in meditation like this, we could just place our banana on our hands. So as soon as the sun comes up, we can just stick it in our mouth. Well, that made sense. So they all sat there with the banana, and then this little brother, he said, I don't know, it's not so convenient. You know, you want to do something or pick something up or have a glass of water and your banana's going to fall out of your hand. It's not a good place to keep it. I reckon we just keep it in our mouths, but don't swallow. So, yeah, right. So they all sat there like this with their cheeks bulging. And then this little baby monkey is looking right and left, and he went, swallowed his banana. And then his sister said, well, if he's swallowed his, I'm going to swallow mine. And they said, oh, nobody's keeping this precept anymore. Let's forget all about it. So this is an old story from India. And I think it, apart from being a story I like to tell, it has an important lesson to teach. And that is why the way in which we go wrong in life is often, usually, one in which we make small, quite reasonable steps. Each one in itself seems quite okay, but incrementally it becomes not okay at all. And a simile I often like to give is imagine someone who's extremely self-confident and they believe that they have a really excellent sense of direction, absolutely convinced that they could walk in a straight line from dawn to dusk without a compass and without any surrounding landmarks. Okay, so a person's taken out to the middle of the desert somewhere and starts walking in a northerly direction at dawn, walks all the way until dusk, and he is absolutely convinced he's walked in a straight line. And so the scientist, whoever, is in charge of this experiment, gets out his compass, and amazing, he's walked in a straight line from dawn to dusk. He's deviated by 1 degree in the whole 10 hours that he's been walking. Fantastic. Second day, he carries on. He walks in the same incredibly straight way without any landmarks to help him. End of the day, look, only 1 degree off a straight line. And it carries on. So after 90 days, what direction is he going in? North has become west, another 90 days, and he's going south. But subjectively, he feels, and he's absolutely confident and convinced, he's been walking absolutely straight. And I would suggest this is a more common phenomena than we would perhaps like to accept or acknowledge, that our major mistakes that we make are incremental and ones in which we have no subjective sense of deviating from the path that we have agreed upon for ourselves and one which we are committed to. For this reason, the precepts are incredibly important. They are the compass on the most basic level. They are objective standards which we can't massage, we can't mold, we can't manipulate to suit us. And I think it's very important to remember the extent to which the precepts are part of the training rather than a preparation for it. I often characterize Buddhism in contrast to the religions that grew up in the Middle East, which are essentially belief systems, as Buddhism being a different family of religions, or a different species of religion, if you like, being not a belief system, but an education system. And it is what would be called these days a holistic education system, one in which the education of conduct, emotion, thought, wisdom must be carried on simultaneously. And I think as Buddhists, most of us will be familiar with the idea that inner transformation will have an effect on conduct. If we, for instance, practice mindfulness on a regular basis, then we would hope to be more aware of the way in which we conduct ourselves and treat the people around us, and generally perform our duties and responsibilities in daily life. If we practice loving kindness meditation on a regular basis, then we would hope that that would express itself in the way we relate to the people around us. But I think what may often be overlooked to a certain extent is the way in which keeping precepts can produce inner transformation. The very simple example, a mosquito bites. Now, most human beings live on automatic pilot. There's not much choice. There's just so much to deal with. It's not possible to give equal attention to everything. But it does mean that we are often on automatic pilot in areas of life which it would be better not to. And in the case of small nasty creatures biting us, then the automatic pilot tells us just to slap it. And then if you're a Buddhist on automatic pilot, then you say, oh, sorry, afterwards. I didn't mean it. But if you take a precept, then what you need to do is to have that the consciousness of the memory of that precept in the top drawer of your mind, or it's right there. So that in that scenario where the mosquito bites you, then hopefully what happens is that as you're about to swat the mosquito, you suddenly, oh, what's happening? Mm-hmm. Now that's an incredibly significant event in the life of a sentient being, because you have interrupted the automatic instinctual behavior with a moment of awakening. You've woken up, literally. And so that's a moment of mindfulness has interrupted a stream of mindlessness. So where does that mindfulness come from? What is that mindfulness? Well, that mindfulness is the recollection of a precept, the precept not to kill. So, you know, how do you practice mindfulness in everyday life? It's something I was talking about a couple of days ago. Well, precepts play a central role in this. You are mindful of precepts. Your mindfulness arises based upon the precept. Mindfulness means bringing to mind, recollecting. You recollect, this is your precept. Now, when you stop through the arising of mindfulness, choice arises, freedom. What shall I do? I really want to swat this mosquito or not? Is there an alternative? What would be the right thing to do? All these kinds of considerations become possible based upon the arising of mindfulness, which is the recollection of the precept. So now you can just blow it away. So it's the mindfulness allows the wisdom faculty to do its work in time before it's too late. We're all wise before the event, after the event, but the challenge is to be wise, you know, at the crucial moment. And so, you know, question is, you know, why do, you know, how is it that intelligent people do stupid things? Well, you know, you're intelligent, you know, until you're stupid. You know, it's not like an intelligent person is doing a stupid thing. There's intelligence and then there's stupidity alternating in the mind. So the way to increase the amount of intelligence in the mind is practice of mindfulness, and precepts provide a very good foundation for this. So the I think that there's a lot to be learnt from the monk's discipline. The idea of the monk's discipline is like you have like a number of concentric walls to protect you. And the idea is that if you you are careful and diligent in looking after the external wall, then you don't have to worry about the internal walls. And so that may mean that sometimes monks can seem kind of finicky or sort of obsessed about minor details. And that's because you don't see, well, that's the outer wall of a structure. So, for instance, in relations with women, there are all these rules about not speaking alone with a woman, not being alone with a woman, not speaking more than a few sentences, and these can seem quite kind of artificial and unnecessary. But if a monk is devoted to his sila, out of respect to the Buddha and Dhamma and Sangha, then he protects himself, because if you can be sure that if he maintains that standard, then there's no question that any scandal or anything more serious could occur, because he's maintaining the outer walls of his discipline. And I think that in lay life, this same kind of principle can be applied, that you can create training rules for yourself in addition to the five precepts or the eight precepts, taking into account your own particular flaws and difficulties that you have. Something I suggest for married people is to have certain standards for being alone with a member of the opposite sex, or speaking on the telephone with a member of the opposite sex. It becomes not a sort of a strict, necessarily a very strict thing that makes you feel constricted and awkward, but after a time it becomes the outer wall and a protection for you, but most importantly, a recollection. It becomes an object of mindfulness. You're mindful when you speak or when you're alone with a member of the opposite sex who's not your partner. And I think there is a scope for skillful use of precepts and training rules in this way. So the compass provided by precepts is quite an excellent one, a formidable one, but of course it is not sufficient. We almost also have to be looking within and developing that familiarity and ease with being alone with ourselves, being a good friend to yourself. And indeed, it's dana, generosity, and sila, which are the Buddhist answer to question the problems of low self-esteem. Self-esteem given first through giving. When you give something, you make an improvement in someone's life. You make a difference. You make a difference through giving. You show that you can make a positive difference on the world through an action of yours. That's a wonderful feeling. And keeping precepts leads that kind of confidence that you have boundaries that you can maintain and that you want to maintain, even sometimes when there is a lot of pressure not to stay within those boundaries. The first time I came to America in 1991, I went to a town in Massachusetts where there was a very large Cambodian refugee population. And the abbot of monastery there was a well-known meditation master. And I asked him, given the fact that so many of the people that came to his monastery were still traumatized from their experiences with the Khmer Rouge. Most of them had, you know, at least 5, 6, or 10 close relations and friends who'd been murdered during that time. So what kind of meditation do you teach? And he said, I teach dana and sila at the moment. It's going to be a few years before these people are ready for meditation. And I think that this may seem strange, but what may even seem stranger, and some of you may know, is it's very hard to pin down a word in Pali which is directly comparable to the word meditation. The word bhavana means development or cultivation. And so it's not confined to the application of a particular meditation technique, but it refers to the effort to abandon the unwholesome and develop the wholesome through body, speech, and mind. So whatever activity you are involved in, if akusala dhammas, unwholesome dhammas, are being reduced, wholesome dhammas are increasing, then that's bhavana. And so you could call that meditation, if you like. So I think there's a too narrow idea of what meditation may be. And looking within enables us to have a much closer idea about what's what. And I was saying to someone earlier that a lot of people get quite depressed about their meditation, you know, feeling it should be so much better than it is, or that they've been practicing for some long time now and they don't see any results. But what do we mean? What are the results that we should hope to have realized by now? I think the most important result, and I think if anyone can claim this, then you can say you're a successful meditator, and that is that you haven't stopped. If you haven't stopped meditating, you're still meditating, you're a success. So take it from there. Now, another very basic accomplishment that you may not have noticed is that the in a period of meditation, suddenly you think some problem, some difficulty that you've been brooding about, worrying about for a long time, and you think, what's the point? It's just so much. It's nothing. You can sort of laugh at yourself even. Let it go. This is not any great profound insight into the three characteristics. This is taking the mind into a slightly quieter space. You develop a new perspective on the things that are going on in your life. In the same way, you may suddenly think, oh, I really shouldn't let this go on anymore. It's not particularly dangerous or harmful right now, but if I don't do anything about it, then very soon it will be. So this is a basic accomplishment from meditation that I'm sure all of you have to a certain extent experienced. At the very least, you should be observing that you don't get lost quite so much in daily life, and that when you do realize that you've lost your place, then you can reestablish your attention more quickly. So mindfulness is like a muscle that you develop through meditation. Your mind wanders, you bring it back, wanders, you bring it back, and that's not a waste of time. Every time you bring your mind back, you're strengthening the mindfulness muscle. I realized I didn't really conclude what I was going to speak about just now, which is one of the problems about this kind of public speech, where you don't decide beforehand what you're going to say. But the talking about a muscle reminds me of this same analogy and following on about the way that precepts are a transformative force. Through keeping a precept, let's return to the mosquito analogy for a moment, then every time that you do not act upon the intention to harm, that intention is weakened. So just as every time you bring your mind back to the meditation object, mindfulness is strengthened, in the same way every time you don't act upon a particular unwholesome intention, that intention is weakened. So a cat comes round for milk, you put out the plate of milk, the glass of milk, cat comes every day. You stop, the cat still comes for a day or two, still hopes, against hope it's going to get some milk. Finally it realizes it's not go somewhere else. Now, if the intention to harm is repeatedly recognized and not acted upon, it starts to atrophy. It becomes much weaker. And when that practice is maintained over a period of years, then the feelings of loving kindness for sentient beings of all descriptions arises quite naturally, even without intensive metta meditation practice. If you'll excuse me if I give a personal example, some time ago I left on alms round a little bit later than I usually did, so I was rushing. And as I walked down, my foot almost trod on a poisonous snake. And I was startled, and I exclaimed. I said, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that." As I walked on Bindaba, I had this great sense of rapture, you know, in the in the training that I'd received, and that the automatic response to that situation was not of fear and anger or whatever, but it was an apology for frightening the snake. And that is something that is not particular to me. I think all bhikkhus who've been practicing this training for a long time will have probably similar kinds of experiences. So the attention and the mindfulness of precepts, not acting upon unwholesome dhammas, allows for the arising of wholesome dhammas. You have to clear the space before the wholesome dhammas can arise. But in the inner practice, what we conventionally call meditation, I think another very important milestone, if you like, is when we begin to experience the states of mind in which the defilements are not particularly prominent or are temporarily absent. I have another personal story here. In 1976, as a layman, I was up in the Nilgiri Mountains in South India, and I met a young American man who was like me in many respects, but differed in one very important respect. He had a lot of money, and he said, "Would you like to go walking up in the mountains? Because I've got enough money to hire a guide." And they're all over India at that time. There were these deserted bungalows, which were inspection bungalows from the time of the British Raj. And you could make arrangements to get the key and spend, if you had a particular path to follow, you could ask to spend the night in these bungalows. So this is what we were doing, walking through the mountains and spending the night in these old deserted British Raj bungalows. But one night, there was no bungalow, and we went to stay the night in a village. It was a very remote area, and very exciting for the villagers because they'd never seen any Westerners before. And so in the evening, afternoon, I guess, I decided to go down to the stream and have a bath. And as I walked out of the village towards the stream, I looked behind me and there was a long string of children. I felt like the Pied Piper of Hamelin. And they wanted to see what I was going to do. And so I got down to the stream and got my soap out, and they were absolutely fascinated with soap. You know, what's that stuff? And I gave a soap to this little girl, and she started to rub it on her hand, and she squealed, and everybody's, wow, and it was like her skin changed color. I think she probably thought she's going to turn into a Westerner. You know, she was after the initial fear and consternation passed away, everybody was absolutely enthralled, and everyone was throwing the soap, and everybody was soaping up and laughing. It's a very warm memory I have. But initially, of course, she thought that the dirt was her, and some part of her was being removed by the soap. And it was when she found out that that was not the case, she started to laugh and was extremely happy. And so you can probably work out the analogy here that we're all familiar, I'm sure, with the idea of defilements of mind. It's not such a good phrase, that, but the idea that there are unwholesome dhammas which rise and pass away in our minds, but which are not inherent in the mind. They're not who we really are. We accept that as Buddhists, as a working hypothesis out of faith, but it's only when the mind is calm, reaches the state of lucid calmness in meditation, in which those defilements are at least temporarily absent, that we realize that they are not part of who we are, that they really are some things that arise and pass away according to causes and conditions. And that, again, is not a very profound insight into three characteristics, but it is an important change in the foundation of our worldview, the way that we look at ourselves and look at others even, and shows us the path ahead. Now, if you experience the mind, that sense of knowing and clarity, it's called lucid calmness, then when the defilements arise subsequently, you have a new perspective on them, and the feeling is one of that the mind has become sullied, has become dirtied, has become clouded. Ah, then you see, well, that's why the Buddha called it kilesa, or defiling. And it's when you have the contrast of the undefiled mind, even if momentarily or even just for a short time, then you can now at last understand what this word defilement means and the path towards the transcendence of defilement starts to become clearer to you. But it is something that we need to do again and again and again and again. There's a story of an Ajahn who asked his disciples, "Do you meditate every day?" And they say, "Almost every day." He said, "That's very good." He said, "Yes. Monday I almost meditated. Tuesday I almost meditated. Wednesday I almost meditate every day." He said, but so that's not good enough, obviously. So it's that intention to be with yourself, and when you have that intention to be present, to be awake, then the distinction between what you do when you're sitting with your legs crossed and your eyes open and when you're doing other things becomes a lot less rigid and reach that kind of Buddhist holy grail of continuity of mindfulness through the postures. It's that effort to awaken, to be awake to what's going on. I was just in Russia a couple of weeks ago, and I checked out because I'd heard this and I wanted to make sure. And I asked what is the word for alarm clock in Russia, and it's budilnik. It comes from the word Buddha. The alarm clock is something that wakes you up. It's derived from the Pali Sanskrit. So you know, this is something that we stress a lot, and in Buddhism, and think that in the actual meditation practice itself, it's worthwhile re-examining the relationship you have with the meditation object, and how do you talk to yourself about what you're doing? How do you frame it? How do you explain it to yourself? Because if you think you're concentrating on something, that there's a certain kind of atmosphere and a certain expectation there. Whereas if you conceive it in terms of awakening to the in-breath, awakening to the out-breath, that's a very different feeling. And I think that it's useful to have a number of different kind of attitudes to the breath which you can tailor to particular situations. For instance, if you're kind of tense and getting rather sort of gaining ideas in meditation or getting uptight about meditation, then just using the idea of enjoy. So enjoy an inhalation. Enjoy the sensation of an exhalation. What's that like? Very different idea. You're doing exactly the same thing. You're breathing in, you're breathing out, but enjoying the sensation of an inhalation, enjoying the sensation of an exhalation. And this is based upon, I think, an important point of Dhamma is that the reason that the mind wanders a lot is because it's more enjoyable than being with the breath. So if you can enjoy being with the breath more than you can with a memory or a fantasy, then meditation will become much easier. But if the sense of enjoyment is carried too long, then the sense of awakening and wakefulness may be lost, and then you have to come back to the wakefulness. But what I'm really pointing to is that we start off our meditation and our let's say relationship with the breath with certain underlying ideas, and should try to make those conscious. Perhaps the most important condition for meditation is what we call chanda. Wonderful word, this chanda, and it's wholesome desire. So we have this teaching that there is unwholesome desire, which is called tanha, which is the cause of suffering, and then there is wholesome desire, or chanda, which is the cause of success. So it's not that Buddhism teaches that all desire is wrong and causes suffering, just as Buddhism doesn't teach that. I don't think that everything is suffering. I don't think that phrase actually means anything. You know, it's like I saw a cartoon once where a little baby fish says to its mum, why is everything so wet? And if you say to a fish, you know, life is wet, what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. And if you say life is suffering, that doesn't mean anything. I mean, the point is that life of ignorance and craving is suffering, but there are four noble truths, not two, and there is liberation from suffering through transcendence of craving. So we in Buddhism, we're constantly facing this misinterpretation, and that's been around for a long time, that Buddhism teaches you shouldn't have any desires, and people say, well, you just sort of end up like a vegetable doing nothing because you shouldn't have any desires. But Buddha says you should have wholesome desires, not unwholesome desires. Or Buddhism teaches kamma, which means, serves them right. You know, it's their kamma, which the Buddha never taught at all. And the Buddha was the first person to ever come up with the idea of human rights. You know, there are eight human rights that the Buddha discovered and taught: right view, right thought, right speech, right action. You know, this is 2,500 years. So, yeah, I think I'm going beyond my time. and so to avoid becoming too frivolous, and I shall end my Dhamma talk at this point.